Host comes to chair social epistemology at the University of Warwick. Welcome again.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sharon. Thanks for everyone for inviting me here. I don't know how many times I've been at this place, but many times. And I think this is a very, very important and very tricky kind of issue. If you had a look at the title of my talk, it begins to illustrate the trickiness of what we're talking about here. Because I make a reference in the title to this phrase. It's an English phrase, actually a British phrase, curate's egg, in describing neoliberalism in terms of its impact on higher education policy, and one might say the impact of neoliberalism more generally on the world. And so this idea of the curate's egg, it refers to a cartoon that appeared in Punch in the middle of the 19th century. A curate, in case you don't know, is a parish priest, basically, and in the cartoon, the priest is having lunch with the bishop. And the bishop is this very kind of important guy, and the priest is kind of obviously obsequious and so forth. And the bishop says to the curate, looks like you have a bad egg there, right? So the curate's eating an egg. This is the context. And the curate says, well, you know, actually there's some very good parts to this egg. The idea here, right, it's meant to be somewhat ironic because when, you know, one wonders what it's like to have an egg that's partly good and partly bad, right? Isn't this, you know, an egg is kind of a holistic thing from the standpoint of eating, and so it would be pretty difficult to kind of disaggregate the badness and goodness, but nevertheless, that seems to be the case. And that was how it was originally presented. But over the last 150 years, this phrase, curate's egg, actually has acquired, you might say, a kind of more Hegelian quality to it. Okay? In the sense that when we use the phrase curate's egg in English these days, we often mean something that on the surface seems really bad, but may have some redeeming feature to it. Right? And there's a sense in which if you can make it through the bad, the good might not be so bad. It might be quite good, actually. Right? So there is this kind of contemporary use of the phrase curate's egg in English, which I think applies to neoliberalism. Okay? So this is why we have this kind of title here, to give you a sense of where I'm coming from on this matter. Because I certainly don't want to say that the kinds of kind of radical austerity and some sense of austerity policies that have been enforced in the name of neoliberal regimes haven't caused a lot of pain and suffering. No, I'm not going to deny that, but it's for your own good. Right? And I do think that if you can take that part on board, okay, then there might be some sense to this idea of neoliberalism as a kind of reform strategy in higher education and even society more generally. Now, where am I coming from on this? Well, I think the first thing to say is, of course, I live in the UK, and the UK is kind of the great capital and exporter of neoliberalism. So in a sense, we have it all around us all the time. And I do think it's one of the interesting historical markers, which, you know, I mention here now, in case historians in the future don't realize this, is that the phrase neoliberalism wasn't really all that well known in the United States, okay, until the latter years of the Blair administration. Okay, because during the period when Blair introduces the 3,000 pound tuition fees and all these things that in a way set into motion the kind of neoliberal reform of higher education that we see in Britain today, my American friends didn't quite know what was going on there. They knew neoconservative. And I was very quick to point out that actually neoconservative and neoliberal, though they may overlap with regard to certain specific issues, like going to war, you know, in Iraq, which got George Bush and Tony Blair in bed together, nevertheless, ideologically, somewhat different, okay? They're somewhat different, and I just want to focus on the neoliberal side because I don't think neoconservatism, in fact, illuminates very much about what is key about neoliberalism. In fact, I think the way to begin thinking about neoliberalism is as kind of a left-wing movement. A kind of liberal left movement, okay? May not be to every kind of typical leftist liking, but nevertheless, in terms of the roots of the movement, And this is where it gets very interesting in terms of the history of the UK political thinking and so forth. What we need to do is to go back to the founding of the Fabian Society. Okay, and some of you may know in the history of socialism, Fabianism was supposed to be the great alternative to the sort of revolutionary Marxism of the early 20th century. That was the what became kind of the paradigm for a lot of socialist thinking. Right, so the Fabian movement, which began in the late 19th century, and this is a very, I don't know how much. My guess is that people in this country actually would know about Fabianism more than other people would. I mean, does the term Fabian mean something to people here? How many have heard of it? I'm just curious. Not as many as I thought, actually. I thought there'd be more. But here's the idea, okay? The sort of people we're talking about here are the people who founded the London School of Economics. Okay? And the thing about the London School of Economics was it was established as a kind of counterpoint to Oxford and Cambridge in terms of providing the kind of knowledge that future leaders would need to have. And what they need to have as far as future leaders is not knowledge of the classics, right, or the humanities in the broad ancient sense, which was still very much taught at Oxford and Cambridge, and was very much the background of the people who were, in fact, you know, the MPs and the prime ministers and so forth in the UK. But rather, what you needed were these kind of new disciplines that were coming on stream, which had a kind of more kind of, in a way, at least a kind of passing acquaintance with natural scientific ways of doing things, called the social sciences. Okay, so the idea of having a university that's social science based, so economics, sociology, politics understood in a more scientific way, you know, all of these things, right? And what were you trying to do? You're trying to train future leaders. Now the now this, in a way, you might say, is the most obvious and impressive contribution of the Fabian movement today. And it draws your attention to one thing about this movement, was that the kind of change you want in terms of reforming society wasn't going to happen quickly. And that the primary lever has to be, as it were, a generation or two in advance of when you want the action to take place. And this is where you start to see the Fabian mentality differing in terms of the time horizon from, let's say, the Bolsheviks. Okay, who basically thought, you know, you take advantage of a crisis as it appears and boom, you get a new society on street. And you just wait for the moment. And then you act violently, but ideally, relatively briefly, and then utopia takes place. Fabians did not believe this. Okay? Now, in fact, the way the Fabians diagnosed the problems with society, so you have to understand here that these Fabians, and in terms of people, the founders of the London School of Economics were Sidney and Beatrice Webb. You may know about those guys. Fellow travelers included H.G. Wells, the science fiction writer, and one of the candidates for the first chair in sociology at the LSE. Another one was George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, okay, and John Maynard Keynes was kind of a fellow traveler as well, though not officially a member of the movement. And so you get the sense of the sort of people we're talking about here. These are people who are, in a sense, are very interested in reforming society, very much thinking in terms of what we would now call a welfare state, and pretty much targeting their interest at elites, right? But a certain kind of elite. And this then brings us to the question of what exactly has been holding back society, and what is the sense in which society has been held back? Now here the Fabians, I think, in a very explicit way, share a lot of the assumptions of the classical capitalists. Okay, and one of them is the idea that capitalism is this great mechanism for unleashing human potential that will lead to kind of unprecedented amounts of productivity and prosperity and all the rest of it, and that the things that are holding us back are the social and legal arrangements that we have at the moment that prevent people from being all that they can be. Now that's a very familiar socialist theme. Okay? Fabians definitely have that. Now, the Fabians thought that the main problem, the way you want to really target this, is in terms of inherited wealth. Okay? So if you look at the kind of economic thinking that comes from the Fabian movement, it is very much against the idea of wealth being transmitted hereditarily without the people receiving the wealth ever being expected to do anything to add to that wealth. So they flirted with ideas, for example, of the single tax idea of Henry George. Some of you may know about the American economist from the late 19th century, who was a very kind of populist figure who believed that, you know, you could solve all the world's problems if you just taxed unused land. That's a very Fabian idea, actually. Okay. Here's the thing. Okay. And this is where the Fabian movement, in a way, has some baggage, you might say, from the standpoint of contemporary, what should we say, political sensibilities. The Fabian movement also took very seriously the idea of eugenics. Okay, and the aspect of here I think you need to understand eugenics in a particular way, because I do think as a result of Nazism and all the rest of it, there is this sense of eugenics as simply a matter of weeding out. Negative eugenics, as it's often called. But I think the Fabian movement was actually interested in what you might call the positive eugenics. That is to say, to find the sources of human potential that aren't being fully exploited, that perhaps come from people who, let's say, come from lower class backgrounds or whatever, who have not had the opportunity yet to be able to express themselves and to do all they can do for society and so forth. And those people need to be identified. Now, this was in fact the original eugenics vision, and it's one that Francis Galton, if you're familiar with him, he was another candidate for the first chair in sociology at the London School of Economics. You can imagine how the discipline would have gone if any of these guys, Wells or Galton, would have gotten the chair, right? I mean, they ended up with this milquetoast Hobhouse, who was this kind of liberal. But the point is that Galton, right, was very deliberately modeling this on kind of Plato strategy in the Republic. For, you know, because if you read Plato actually holds a kind of view like Galton's, in the sense that, you know, the way society is organized, the best people don't necessarily rise to the top. You actually have to go look for them, right? And they may in fact come from backgrounds that you don't expect them to come from. And just because someone comes from a privileged background doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to produce people who are really up to the job of running society. So you have to engage in some kind of discriminating selection process. And so Plato actually talks about, you know, that the talent scout for the philosopher king roams around, looks for, where are those smart people? Okay? So eugenics is very much in this kind of mold, okay? And it's very much an issue of equality of opportunity, right, as we talk about it nowadays. It is very much a kind of movement about equality of opportunity. I think the way in which this thing gets transformed, because people, as you know, people stay with the eugenics movement for various lengths of time. Now, some people get off the eugenics train early, others stay on till the end. But I think the way to think about the spirit in which this argument was being made is very similar to what we talk about these days as human capital. We're trying to cultivate human capital. That this is the point of all of our social interventions, is the cultivation of human capital. And this is why education becomes actually a very important thing for the state to take an interest in, as well as the healthcare system and things of that kind. And I should say, you know, again, as a historical point, the connection between eugenics and human capital is pretty tight, in the sense that the person who first uses the term as a title of a book and an idea is Irving Fisher, an American economist who is tied to the progressive movement in the United States in the early 20th century, okay, which was a kind of fellow traveler, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, people of that kind. They were sort of the people who basically placed America on the world stage as this kind of great agent of democracy that we're all so familiar with today. Right, they sort of established the American century as it's come to be known in the 20th century. Okay, these guys were the so-called progressives. They've moved America away from its kind of inward-looking focus that had dominated most of the early history of the country. And Irving Fisher was like a house economist to these guys, and he was also the first president of the American Eugenics Society. And so the idea here being that when we were doing that, we should in fact have human capital as one of the factors of production that we put in our welfare functions, in our national economic policy, just as we do agricultural policy, you know, land utilization, all these kinds of things. Okay, and that we should actually have a human capital policy, right, on the same level. Why not? This is what progressive society should do. And the Fabian movement was very much on top of that. And in fact, if you look at the, another person to bring into the story here is William Beveridge, who is known as the father of the British welfare state. He was the director of the London School of Economics during its period of mass expansion, where it becomes this kind of world-class institution in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, prior to World War II. His idea, and he bought into all this, and his idea was that what the LSE really needed was a foundational social science discipline, the name of which would be social biology. Okay? And so he brought in 1937, courtesy of the Rockefeller Foundation, which provided all the money, this guy Lancelot Hogben, who's a geneticist. British geneticists have been floating around the world a lot, had most recently been at the University of Cape Town, and a kind of Marxist figure, and a person who was a kind of, you might call, soft eugenicist, in that he believed that much more research needed to be done, but that there was something to be said about planning the future of humanity in some kind of explicit sense. And he was brought in on the condition that he could bring in animal laboratories into the LSE, because he worked mostly on animals. But the people he trained, including David Glass, became the signature people who were involved in the big quantitative longitudinal surveys of people across their lives that started to characterize, right, quantitative British sociology after World War II, and very much fed into the policy formulations of the welfare state during that period where the welfare state really grew, right? So in this period, you know, from the end of World War II to the rise of Thatcher. Okay, and these were people who were emanating from the LSE and were students of David Glass, who was a student of Hogben. Okay, Hogben himself left eventually because the LSE turned out not to be hospitable, because he got into problems with Friedrich von Hayek and all the economists there, and there's a kind of a story about that. But the point here is that all of this that I'm talking about here was part of this Fabian vision. Now, one of the things that also starts to happen to this Fabian vision as we move into the period after the Russian Revolution. So remember, you know, London School of Economics is founded in 1895, right? And the Fabian movement is really kind of, in a way, most visible as a movement in this period and leading up to World War I. I would say that, you know, that's where the classic Fabian moments are. And then it's after World War I when socialists, people who think of themselves as wanting a kind of strong sense of a planned society, have to start to reckon with the significance of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Okay? And that's where you start to get some of these guys migrating to this other point of view. Okay, so this is the story. This is how we start to move into neoliberalism. That neoliberalism is basically a kind of response to what they thought kind of was probably... So the people who we call neoliberals now were the people who did not think that the Bolshevik Revolution was a success for socialism, at least in the way they were understanding it. Okay? And in fact, they, you know, because one of the things that I think that the Fabians found attractive about Lenin initially, and you still see this kind of sentiment. There's a very famous interview that H.G. Wells does with Joseph Stalin in the 1930s in The New Statesman. You can find it online. And it's quite interesting because there, in a sense, you see the difference between the Fabian mentality and the Bolshevik mentality, because Wells, you know, is basically telling Joe Stalin, how can you trust these working class people? You know, these people, you know, they don't like, you know, sure, they were being oppressed by all these aristocrats and things like this, and, you know, and so not surprisingly, they followed you, but you can't literally expect these people to lead. You can't expect really to be governing things by these kind of populist councils and things like that. You really can't believe that, can you? And Joe Stalin says, I don't trust you elite bourgeois guys, blah, 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 right? And so that sort of disagreement remains, right? But I think one of the things that's very interesting, if you read this this interview between Wells and Stalin, is the sense that, you know, Wells is telling Stalin things like, why do you promise the people so much? You obviously aren't going to deliver on it, and then all you're going to end up doing is demonizing your enemies, right? And then you're going to get the people all worked up, and yet they're still not going to have their lives improved. Why don't you get them to think in a more long-term perspective? Why don't you actually have some real intelligent people running the country? You know, I mean, this is kind of like, you know, and think in terms of two or three generations. right? You know, and you know, Stalin is just very patronizing to Wells and says, you don't realize the wisdom of the people and the kind of local knowledge they have and all this kind of stuff, right? And so this kind of impasse remains, and I think what you end up getting, you know, starting in the 1920s and certainly by the 1930s, you end up getting this kind of migration of people, not Wells himself, but you get a migration of people who start to worry about the following things, about what's happening in the world. One is that world's become a very complicated place. Mass media, people finding out lots of things. Suffrage has been extended massively after World War I, right? You get a constitutional democracy in Germany. All these things are coming on board, right? There is at least formal recognition that people's own opinions need to be taken seriously. But this leads to enormous amount of volatility in terms of elections. Parliamentary democracy as an institution that has to incorporate all these new voices isn't really suited for it, and so you end up getting this kind of endless dithering that you see in Weimar, for example. Okay? On top of that, labor unions are getting stronger, they're getting more formal representation. Okay? And on top of that, you're seeing that the stock market is just going up and down, up and down, up and down, because there's no regulation of the movement of capital. All these things are happening at the same time in the 1920s. Okay? And so the thing that I think is very clear about these people who we call neoliberals is that, first of all, they don't trust democracy. At the end of the day, the kind of elitism that was very much there in the Fabian movement just comes full center stage, right? So I don't even, you know, no illusion of democracy anymore, right? In a sense, you can't really, you know, we're opening the floodgates to people to participate in politics, and look what they're doing, and, you know, and they're just going to become fodder for dictators now that we've got mass media, right? All the kinds of problems that Walter Lippmann in the United States, if you're familiar with Walter Lippmann, he was complaining about in the 1920s, especially in a series of famous debates that he had with John Dewey. So John Dewey, this grand old man of kind of, you know, progressive liberalism, but sort of a guy who never really caught on to radio, okay? And so, you know, Dewey, who still talks about, you know, we need to trust the wisdom of the people and we can turn the whole world into a New England town meeting and all this kind of stuff. Lippmann was saying, no, the world's changed, guy. You have now allowed most of the population to be able to vote. You now have radio where anyone who has a microphone can broadcast their message. What do you think is going to happen if somebody doesn't take control? Right? And so what Lippmann... So the Walter Lippmann colloquium gets established in 1937, and this is the where neoliberalism comes from. Right? Namely, how are we going to straighten out the world to save what is good? And what is good, again, to go back to the original Fabian message, what is good about this whole idea of social planning that made the Fabians sort of fellow travelers with the Bolsheviks for a while was the idea of trying to unleash human potential, enabling people to be all that they can be. And that what was holding them back was all of these kind of regressive, you know, inheritance policies that prevented people from really proving that they can be what they can be. Okay? But that the world that we were entering into, right, which was this kind of, you know, untrammeled capitalism, very weak states, where democracy is kind of very volatile and so forth, isn't going to give you that. It's just going to give you catastrophe. Okay? And so this is where you start to, this is the premise from which then the neoliberal thinking starts to develop. And these guys flirt with various kinds of things over the next, you know, so we've got the Walter Lippmann colloquium in 1937, and, you know, Thatcher's elected in 79 and Reagan in 80. And so that's quite a long time. So they are actually working on this for a couple of generations before it really pays off. Okay. And I do think that needs to be taken quite seriously, because I certainly remember, you know, I went to university in the mid-70s, just before this so-called neoliberal revolution actually got realized, and people back then, when I was a student, still thought that Hayek was a lunatic, right? He was just some kind of, you know, Ayn Rand libertarian fantasy figure, not the kind of guy you'd give Nobel Prize to, okay? But that Nobel Prize actually helped him go up the ladder a bit. But the point was, so there was a very quick shift, and a lot had to do with the way in which these neoliberals actually were thinking in terms of the long term, and sort of getting them instituted at various universities where they could end up teaching the next generation of leaders. Places like University of Chicago, for example, in economics, right, is a most obvious case in point. And then these people would go to other countries and then become very important people there. And while they did in the beginning flirt with the idea of backing some kind of autocrat, you know, the kind of person that, let's say, Pinochet turns out to be, right? Pinochet, in a sense, matches that description. They didn't really go for that in the beginning at all. They thought this was going to be a very long-term thing. So now, what is it that these guys wanted to do? What did they think? What was the image? And how much more time would you say I have?
Fair bit, actually.
I wasn't thinking I was finished, but I just wanted to get a sense of the time.
You have at least five. Even
okay. Look, the image here, when it gets down to it, was one in which the state would, you might say, the state would take monopoly control over the production of markets. Right? That's the key insight. Right? So in other words, rather than thinking of the state and market as opposing things, which is what, you know, the sort of free market capitalism was all about, right? Neoliberalism, right, actually is still dedicated to the idea of a strong state, right? And so then the question becomes, what business is the state in, right? And in the kind of more usual welfare state socialist models, the state's in the business of, in some sense, guaranteeing the provision of various kinds of health, education, so forth. But in the case of neoliberalism, the state takes a more second-order role. Right, so in other words, the state turns health into a market, turns education into a market, right? Turns everything that in a you know, normal socialist regime or even welfare state regime would be provided directly, it moves to the second order, and as it were, organizes the market, and it's within the market that then the providers are determined. Okay. Now, part of the idea behind this, and this is a very kind of very Enlightenment kind of mentality, I would say, 18th century Enlightenment mentality going on, is a belief in actually a belief in the power of markets, right? As a kind of mechanism. I mean, one of the things, you know, we use this word mechanism in social science to kind of talk about a kind of relatively contained but specifiable causal process, right? That on a like a little machine, right? A mechanism. And I think in this respect, these neoliberals definitely think of markets as mechanisms. They're things that actually can produce the kinds of results you want in the right way. And why is this? Well, because what markets do is to basically create competitive fields, which then forces everybody, both producers and consumers, to think more critically about what it is they really want. Okay? So in other words, I think, I mean, this is certainly, when you look at somebody like Condorcet, because we often talk about Adam Smith as the great promoter of markets, but Adam Smith, I think, is coming from a somewhat different place on this. But if we're talking about the idea of the market as something the state uses, right, because think about France, okay? France in the 18th century, we've got a mercantile system where the whole economic structure is pretty much based on patronage, where there are monopolies for the production of various goods and services. So, the solution is you bring markets into these things, you break those monopolies, you allow for competition, you allow the people who really can produce the kinds of goods that people want to actually have an opportunity to do it. So you create all this opportunity that previously was just absolutely in the hands of the king as patronage. Right? That's the context in which somebody like Condorcet was saying the states could use markets as a way of freeing up opportunity and enabling productivity to take place. So it's a mechanism used by the state in a very strategic kind of way to break up existing monopolies. Now, this kind of mentality, you know, is actually, I think, quite relevant to the way in which reforms in higher education have taken place in the UK. And so here I recall, because I'm sure this name will come up by somebody, Lionel Robbins, Lionel Robbins did this important report in the early 1960s, this was a report that basically created all of these universities, of which mine is one, which are largely campus-based, social science-driven universities that were designed to provide the kind of education that people will need to have in this kind of new, scientifically, technologically advanced world. Okay? These universities, like my own, Lancaster, Essex, these kinds of places, these places, of course, still had classics faculties and, you know, physics faculties and all those kinds of things. But nevertheless, there was this kind of strong social science presence at the heart of the university that previously was not the case in the UK at all, except for this dedicated university called the London School of Economics, which is where Robbins was from. This is often seen as a kind of golden age in terms of opening up access and so forth for people to get a higher education, especially in the UK, where the percentages of people who typically went to higher education were rather low by developed world standards. However, I think the way to understand this idea, given who Lionel Robbins was, he was the chair of the economics department at the LSU who hired Hayek. Okay, he was a guy who spent a lot of his intellectual career polemicizing against John Maynard Keynes by saying that welfare was not a proper object of inquiry for economics because it is too substantive. In a sense, it removes the element of choice from the ends. Right? Because economics is all about a science of choice, in a sense. And the problem is that by talking about welfare, you're already presupposing what people want. Whereas that always has to be left open at every possible level, even at the highest level, which is where welfare operates, it's macroeconomic policy. Okay? This is Robbins. It's this Robbins. And this Robbins was one of the first Fabians who migrated to what this thing, the Walter Lippmann Colloquium, eventually became the Mount Pelerin Society. And some of you may know it more by that name, because now there's been some books and a whole range of scholarship on this matter. And they still meet. You can look it up on the internet. They meet every year. And Robbins is part of that scene, okay? And so the way to interpret what was happening in 1963 with the Robbins Report is that he was basically aiming to break the monopolies of Oxford and Cambridge again, kind of in the way LSD did by itself, but doing it at a systemic level. Okay? Now that is a classic neoliberal move. That is a classic neoliberal move, okay? I mean, the phrase wasn't being used very much back in 1963, but that is part of the same story. Right? That is the idea is to break the monopolies, to open fields up where there is this potential that isn't being realized, open it up to competition, and then let the competition play out. And then you will see, and the idea was, of course, that if you bring all these new players into the academic field, then you're going to force all the other universities to think about, well, are we really investing the right amount of money on these traditional subjects? Because it looks like these newer subjects that the other universities are using to distinguish themselves are actually gaining a lot of students, and they may have some value in the job market and whatever. And so everybody, as a result, has to rethink at a very fundamental level what their priorities are with regard to why they're producing knowledge. And so there's a kind of... And again, I'm presenting this in ideal terms because I think you need to see what the ideal is behind this, is it leads to a kind of collective smartening up of society. Okay? People aren't just relying on wisdom inherited from the past, but rather are constantly being faced with new challenges, new perspectives, and they have to adjust, you know, adapt, come up with something creative, whatever. Okay? And nothing is sacrosanct in this system. Right? Nothing sacrosanct. Now the interesting thing, of course, is we can imagine many different areas of life where this kind of model makes perfect sense. You know, and certainly in terms of, you know, insofar as one regards the sort of mainstream history of capitalism as a success story with regard to production of goods and services and things, you know, you can see that. Now the interesting thing is, why do we balk at this when it comes to issues of health and education? Right, these kind of cherished grounds of the welfare state. What exactly are the objections to opening them up to market considerations of this kind? And I think this, in a sense, is kind of the burden of proof that people on the left have with regard to dealing with neoliberalism. Because neoliberalism, is not, in terms of its self-understanding and in terms of the way it operates, is not a reactionary conservative movement. It's certainly not conservative. It's not conserving anything, in fact. Right? I mean, it's very anti-conservative movement. Right? If anything, it's hyper-liberal. And so then the question then becomes, where does one lodge the objection to it exactly? Right? At what level, in terms of how it's administered? There are lots of different kinds of issues one can raise about this. And I by no means am going to defend the way it's being administered in the UK. But nevertheless, it seems to me that the fundamental idea, if you kind of go through the logic of it historically, is not a screwy idea. Let me put that on the table as a provocative thought. Neoliberalism is not screwy. It makes a certain kind of sense. And I think there's a sense in which that while I think it is important, it is also easy to argue against neoliberalism at the level of its effects. Right? I mean, the effects are real, and they're bad, and all the rest of it. But I do think it is a trickier issue. It's a much more, and maybe this is the kind of thing for this forum, right, is what is the intellectual problem with this? Right? In other words, would a better version of this actually be good? Okay? So let me put that on the table. I'll end there. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, do we have any time for questions at all? Or?
Yes, we have a lot of time for questions.
Okay, I'll take questions. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Lovely, rich, historical view. Not too rich for me. Okay, so I've got to say there's an Austrian moment in the year that comes out of
Ordo-liberalism? Ordo-liberalism, yeah.
But also specifically the relationship between Hayek on the one hand and Popper on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me as Cold War warriors,
mm-hmm.
both Austria, they provide a second moment for LSE, which displaces Keynes' war.
Yeah.
And also, I might say, when you look at the globalization of neoliberalism, also it goes offshore with Hayek when he goes to Chicago in 1960.
Yeah.
So I think you describe the first phase.
Yeah.
And it seems to me there's a second phase there with, if you want to go into that history, and I think I found it really fascinating and very useful. But there's an Austrian moment there.
Yep. No.
And then thirdly, you might say Chicago.
Yeah.
With the growth of human capital theory, not just with Becker, but for the brain of other people.
Sure.
Maybe you want to comment on that.
Well, look, what I will say about, because the problem is that the particular personalities that we're talking about here, both you and me, kind of change their mind. And then I think the thing about these issues as, in a sense, one of the things that I will say about neoliberalism, if nothing else, is that as a group, these people kind of learn from history as it's happening. And they do adjust their views. I give them credit for this, okay? They're not dogmatic at all. I mean, they really do. And one area where I do think they shift, which is quite significant to what you're talking about, is on this business of inherited wealth, okay? Because if, the one thing that, as I was mentioning with the Fabians, and certainly the early period of the neoliberals, they hated inherited wealth, right? They hated these people who just sat on their money and did nothing with it, right? They were really the enemy. The problem is, these guys over time start to get less and less confident about what the state can do with regard to redistribution, okay? And what that ends up meaning is that by the time we get to the period where Hayek and all this stuff actually starts to get institutionalized, these guys are actually quite happy with people who've proved themselves in the marketplace keeping their wealth and passing it on and do what they want with it, because they don't trust the state to do a better job with regard to making the money available in a way that would lead to greater productivity in the society. And if you see the way in which the neoliberal arguments tend to be couched nowadays, that's often the case, right? Where when somebody makes the argument that, why don't we just tax all these rich people and redistribute the wealth and other people would be able to live better lives and things like this, part of the argument back is, well, what would those people do with the money? Would they be as productive as those rich people would? Right? They don't trust the state to be able to actually come up with a kind of formula or a procedure that would actually allow the redistribution of wealth to actually lead to a more productive society. And that is the kind of change that takes place after World War II, And I think is very much characteristic of the way in which neoliberalism has become a political project. It's disappointing. I'm very disappointed by that, to be honest with you. It's a real spanner in the works as far as the story is concerned. Because at the end of the day, they really end up letting the wealthy have the money. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah. First, I want to answer your question, what is the intellectual problem? I think the intellectual problem with the ideas that you've been analyzing is the market mechanism, not neoliberalism in any very general way, but specifically the market mechanism as a foundation of the concept of property.
Mm-hmm.
That's the intellectual problem that we're dealing with. So that's opening that discussion. Then I would like to say that as an economic historian, I don't agree with your historical analysis. I've always been a great fan of Karl Polanyi.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take his great book, The Great Transformation, as a starting point, mm-hmm. discussion, then wouldn't you agree with me that there is a huge difference between the classical liberal state that actually abstains from regulation,
yes.
only regulates when the market mechanism is disturbed.
Yes, that's different from neoliberalism.
Yes. Very different.
Yes, I agree, 100%.
Okay, and in between those, you have the Fabians and the Webbs, and what they do is that they're actually actively trying to reinvent the market mechanism.
Right. I agree with this too. What is it that you don't agree? I mean, yeah, I mean, they want to re-embed the market mechanism within a social planning framework.
Yes.
Yes.
Don't you think that is a hugely different thing from actively proposing a state that abstains from regulation?
I agree. No, I don't think neoliberals believe in the state abstaining from regulation, actually. Okay? I mean, if anything, I think neoliberalism allows an enormous opportunity for lawyers. Right? Because basically what you're going to get are a lot of people who are going to wonder whether they're getting value for money. Right? I mean, if you look at the case of Chile, for example, which is introduced in a very heavy kind of way, market mechanisms into higher education. Right? When students are protesting, they're protesting not getting value for money. It's like a consumer's revolt, basically, in the classic kind of 1960s sense of my car doesn't work, right? These are not people who are saying I want Humboldt, right? These are people who are saying I pay £3,000, I want to get my money's worth, I want a job, I want something, and you're not providing it for me, and you promised it, right? This is what neoliberalism gives you, right? It gives you this opportunity for litigation because the market is a big game where everybody's kind of playing, and so you can start complaining about false advertising. But what the values are that are being advertised, what the values are that you're buying and selling, is completely left open.
Okay, I still suspect that your definition of neoliberalism is too broad.
No, the point is, but it is, no, no, but the point is neoliberalism has nothing to do with the state backing off and just letting the market happen naturally. This is why I didn't talk about Adam Smith, because Adam Smith's rhetoric is very much along these lines. But what I'm talking about is the state as a market creator. And I thought the point you made in the beginning was interesting about the business of the polity turning into a market. Because, of course, that's the final frontier, right? That's when you start to get into sacred space with regard to democracy, right? Right, votes for sale. What's wrong with votes for sale, right? If you're a neoliberal in principle, you're going to have a problem with that. You know, you can't give a good answer to that question.
Actually, we have economists now studying politics and saying just that. You know, it's the theoretical foundation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're right. I think you're right. That's the sacred, that's the taboo moment, you know, where neoliberalism has to tread carefully because people still think we live in a democracy, okay? But nevertheless, of course, as you say quite rightly, there are loads of economists who've already been pushing this idea for a long time. I mean, going back to, if you remember Anthony Downs in the 1950s, some of you who are old enough will remember this man. The Economic Theory of Democracy, 1957. Check it out. Anthony Downs. He's already there. He's already there, okay? But I agree. Because I do think that there is, I think that the spirit of neoliberalism, and this is something that the Fabians had as well, is not especially democratic. That democracy is a kind of relatively low value for them. I think that's true. And that's why these guys, and I think that, in a sense, from the standpoint of the public relations of neoliberalism, is the trickiest problem. Is basically say, well, you know, we should be running elections like we run the X Factor or any of these kind of shows where people vote in and say who they want and pay money and all the rest. Why not? Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, but otherwise, I think you have to, this isn't free market capitalism we're talking about. This is a different kind of beast. This is a different kind of beast. I do grant this, though. I think very often it is talked about, both by friends and foes, as if it were free market capitalism. And I think that's incredibly misguided, mistaken, and does nobody in the argument any justice at all. This is really an issue about what the state is doing. Other people? Yeah.
The effects of liberalism. But still, we are facing the deficit of democracy.
Yes.
In regards related to this kind of ideology. In your description, it is obvious that even on the level of ideal, there is no value really attached to democracy.
That's right.
To say that well, the problem with this ideal is precisely that view of human and society as other political human who are political enemies or this kind of leadership and whatever. Like if anyone is less democratic than Stalin, then well.
Yeah, no, I see your point. I mean, I do think that part of the worldview, this is where I think neoliberalism is really, it gives you a very kind of economistic worldview, right, is that at the end of the day, your purpose in life is to maximize the production of capital, your own capital, and that you don't do yourself a justice if you're not allowed to be as productive as you can be. That's the bottom line for what a human being is, I think, in this picture. And so issues like democracy, you know, only matter insofar as they facilitate this, but they can easily get in the way. Right? And of course, if you look at guys like Hayek is the most anti-democratic guy in the world. Right? I mean, he thinks that voting is a waste of time. Right? He thinks that people should just be, you know, working on what they know about. Work in their small business, engage in their trades. That's what they should do. They shouldn't be trying to think about what the leaders of the country ought to be up to. They're in no position to know that. Okay? So, I mean, I do think that's right. That's right. There is a kind of view of the human being there. But let me say this about that. I don't think this idea of trying to get people to realize their potential and maximize their productivity is actually so far away from what, let's say, socialists have wanted and other kinds of people who we would normally, you know, those of us on the left, would normally like. Okay? I think it's a particular specification of what it means to realize human potential, right, that I think is a question here. But I think the general sentiment is not so different. Because look,
but it's too broad, and you get Aristoteles, and everyone following him would be...
No, but see, but see, the thing about Aristotle, where this is not Aristotle, and this is where the left is not Aristotle, is that Aristotle is a conservative, right? Aristotle actually believes that there's some kind of fact of the matter about what you should be doing, and we have to figure out what that is, and then you'll find your place in society and everything will be cool, right? I mean, well, you know, so in other words, equality is not an issue. There's natural inequality. You have to just figure out what inequality you belong to and everything will be fine. But there isn't this idea of a sort of open-ended sense, right, of you're being able to experiment and find out and try, and this is what the market is supposedly inviting you to do. Right? I mean, and so this is a really, it's a kind of a worldview that's much more open with regard to how human potential is interpreted than what you have had in classical Greece. Right? Which, as you recall, the market was a very circumscribed realm of society. Right? It wasn't that you turned yourself into a market, which is what neoliberals are doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your presentation. I just find it interesting when we do things like genealogical studies in some ways, And how I sort of see, have heard your presentation, and maybe you can correct me on this, is it sort of something like an attempt perhaps to, could we say, to rehabilitate the notion of a contemporary neoliberalism in terms of the leftist orientation or history rather than the rightist version. And while I'm not necessarily convinced that this does much for us in our contemporary world, I would like you to go back to your first point about the curate's egg. What, therefore, is there about this interesting beast within which many of us live, in a socioeconomic environment? What is there about that positive side of it that you will see? Because I think many are familiar with the negative. And what are those leftist type aspects would you really highlight?
Well, to be honest with you, I think it's the... No, it's a good question. It's a good question, and I'll tell you there are some, because I consider myself as part of the left, and so I am interested in rehabilitating this, especially since this movement did begin as a kind of leftist movement. Okay, that's the point. I'm not making that part up. I mean, whether it can be made into a leftist movement again is the question. But I think is very powerful about the neoliberal vision is its kind of nihilism in a way, right? Because so much of what the left has been about has been breaking down privilege, breaking down inheritance, breaking down the fact that if you're born into a certain position in society, that's how you're always going to be and that's how your children are going to be. Okay? And neoliberalism definitely aims to kill that. Okay? And this is where I think it's very interesting if you look at the rise of Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom. The kind of people she brought into government, I mean, some of them were typical old-style Tory conservative types, but others, like, for example, those in the UK will know people like Nigel Lawson, who was a Chancellor of the Exchequer, right? These were people who had kind of careers in business. They weren't, and they were like often Jewish or something. They weren't part of the establishment. Right, see, Thatcher had a lot of Jews in her cabinet. Okay? So the point was that you basically brought in people who were not going to just be reproducing traditional kinds of values. And in fact, you know, one of the things that Thatcher was very much criticized for in her time was for a sort of Philistinism, right? That in a sense she didn't kowtow to a lot of the pieties and things like this. And I think that's a kind of an interesting aspect of this, right, about neoliberalism, because that's something you find quite consistent, a sort of a lack of respect for authority, you know, that everything has to prove itself. Now, the question is the timeline in which you prove itself might not be all that great, okay, but the point is there isn't this de facto, this default position. This is why I say it's anti-conservative in a very deep sense. Right? And because, you know, it is easy to sort of see the world entirely as a battle between neoliberals and socialists, whatever is left of socialists. But the point is, what both of these views have in common is anti-conservatism. Right? Anti-conservatism. And I think that's attractive. And neoliberalism, in a way, has done more to shake up value systems than the left managed to do when it was in the social democracy, in terms of getting people to think in a very radical way about what they're about and what they're doing and all the rest of it. Now, I'm not saying people have kind of come out of this, you know, in the blaze of glory. I'm not saying that. And I'm not denying any of the suffering and so forth that's taken place. But nevertheless, I do think it has kind of called into question a lot of the traditional taken-for-granted stuff in a very profound sort of way. It's just that those of us in the left don't really have a, you know, we really haven't come up with a good answer to this. But what they're doing in that regard, I don't think is so bad. So the idea that we actually have competitors to Oxford and Cambridge is a good idea, right? You know, the idea that you bring in new forms of knowledge in universities and you actually open the doors to allow people to go to them and things like that. That's a good idea, right? I mean, I think the problem is that neoliberalism at the end of the day is value nihilist. In other words, they don't care what happens in the end, right? As long as everybody pays their bills and they get the goods they've been promised. Otherwise, the lawyers come in. And that's the end. That's the end of normativity for neoliberalism, is that. The normativity ends in the courtroom, right? When people who have been promised something don't get it, and then that's when you get your normativity. But otherwise, people can buy and sell whatever they want under the name of education. You see, that's the problem, right? There's a kind of axiological vacuum, right, in this picture. But in terms of the in terms of the destructive side of creative destruction, it's very good. Yeah.
I think the truly radical idea comes out of the phenomenology of markets and the University of Freiburg and the Austrian School. That passes through my to the Chicago School is the notion of constitutional economics.
Mm-hmm.
That what really matters here is the mention of a series of jurisdictional, if you like, rules that construct the market as anti-monopoly or as a certain kind. That seems to me to be a truly revolutionary
yes.
idea.
Yes.
And I think that when you trace that idea, it begins in the late 19th century, in the Austrian school, and then traverses through Hayek, and then across to Chicago, and he moves from the London School of Economics. But it's buoyed up also, it seems to me, and if I can put a plank in here for reviving yet again the Open Society in Tenement, because mm-hmm. it seems to me that Popper plays an unrecognized fundamental role in the Cold War warrior marriage between him himself and Hayek.
Yeah, except that Popper, removed himself from the Mount Pelerin Society after a while because he thought they were going too far down against social democracy. Okay, Popper actually has a much more robust view. I mean, he doesn't believe in Bolshevism, of course, but he certainly does believe in a kind of social democracy, and in fact believes in issues like the government is responsible for the alleviation of suffering and all these kinds of things. And I think when he saw that the guys in the Mount Pelerin Society were kind of putting that on the table as up for grabs, right? Should the government really be care that much about whether people suffer, right? Let the people who are providing health care about it, but the government itself shouldn't have a direct care about it. I think that's when he left the boat.
Sure. And what the good thing comes out that both Popper and Hayek share here is a state phobia, because they see totalitarianism and Nazism. I mean, and Popper, when he writes the Open Society, he describes it as his war effort.
No, I understand, but yes, all of that is true. But I do think that there's a kind of there's a lot of. See, here's the thing, guys like Popper, you might say, doesn't really draw a strong distinction in his writing, including this book, The Open Society, between totalitarianism and authoritarianism. Okay. He dislikes both, and he sees the two as very much together. The proper neoliberals a la Hayek actually accept authoritarianism with regard to the state, right? But what they don't want is a totalitarian state that controls everything. They want a state that has the authority to make markets, right? And they can do that, but then once you've made the market, the people are free to do what they do in the market. This is where Pinochet comes in as a very good bellwether of what neoliberalism looks like in practice in Chile, right? Because this is an authoritarian, right? He's the absolute ruler, but he's not a totalitarian, because in fact what he does is he in fact opens up all these markets, allow all these investors to come in, and all the rest of it. Okay, so that's a very clear distinction in the mind of the neoliberals that Popper did not have. Okay. I mean, that's how I would read that. And I think that helps to explain then, why Popper, in a way, he still remained kind of in the center left in the way in which the rest of these guys didn't.
Sure, but there is the way in which Hayek's work is a series of footnotes to the modern scientific discovery and the parasitic relationship that they had. And it seems to me also that Hayek is much more classical liberal when it comes to his constitutional view of freedom.
Yes.
From say, no, because I see that I'm going to say something else.
Well, should we just?
You have 1 minute.
Well, get Ron in here.
But then we can keep it a little bit short because we're running a little bit after.
Okay.
I just want to point out that we will be more time discussion after Sue's comments, but. the things.
Just a very quick comment on your notion of the curate state, which I really like, if I can say so, and I just want to offer as a footnote to endorse it. I give you an example of the pedagogical relationship. It seems to me that that's a nice way of seeing both the good and the ugly in the pedagogical relationship. It's very easy for those of the left to rush markets, but I think, and you can see that they corrupt, they have potential to corrupt the pedagogical relationship. But on the other side, they do a lot of what you're saying one time that might be valuable in markets. They thrust an exercise into the power of the professors.
Yeah.
They open up a way of responding to the students. They open up a way of taking the students seriously.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm just giving that as an example of the way in which markets have both benefits and disbenefits within higher education. And I think those of us on the left are too ready, too often, to run in and rubbish neoliberalism and the presence of markets. They may actually have some virtue after all. And I'm just really supporting what you're saying.
Thank you.
Well, I think we should. Could you take that in conjunction with Sue's comments later? Because we're running behind time. And can we do that? So you take it after Sue.
When Sue is going to be giving a commentary on the both papers at the end, and maybe you could be the first questioner or something.
Yeah, exactly. You can say that.
Is that okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.